I'm still getting over a sinus thing. It seems like it's going around. It's kind of sinus cold type thing. However, I discovered one thing via TikTok. Listen, there's been a lot of conversations about TikTok lately, about TikTok getting banned for being possibly some kind of avenue for anti-American Chinese propaganda. Okay. And we can talk about that. We can, you know, can have conversations about that. I spoke last week to Kat, Ten Barge of NBC News about this, you know. But here's the thing about TikTok that I've been noticing lately. TikTok's trying to sell me on some really weird, like, manosphere adjacent health trends. Here's what TikTok wants me to be doing. Number one, taking ice baths. Okay. Number one. TikTok wants me getting up every morning and getting in a big bucket of ice water and chilling out in there. Chilling out, literally. It's chilly as well because of the ice.
I like how they dress that up, though. It's not just get in ice water. They have to dress it up. They call it a plunge.
The cold plunge. Yeah.
It just, people are like, oh, I did a plunge today. No, you got in water. Relax.
There's this one guy that I keep seeing on my TikTok For You page, and he's like, he's doing his whole tracking, his whole like ice bath journey. And he's like, it's day 367 of taking an ice bath every single day. And he gets in his ice bath. And then he's kind of like, he gets very zen. And he starts dispensing these little nuggets of like wisdom about how to live your life. And I'm like, who are you? You're just sitting in cold water. Like, why are you qualified to tell me any of this stuff? You're literally just a guy sitting in a big bucket of cold water. You know, there's nothing special about that. But here's the thing. Here's the other big health trend that I think we need to both be taking a look at here. The carnivore diet. This is the other thing that TikTok is very, really wants me to see this content. Maybe this is what's going to make you feel better. Cut out all these nasty seed oils. Cut out the vegetables, the fruits, any of that stuff. Seasoning, of course. You don't want that either. You just got the four basic food groups. Meat, eggs, cream, cheese. And you just eat that with every single meal, every single day of your life. And I think that's going to fix whatever health problems you might have, whether it's a cold or whatever other issues you might have. I think that's what's going to be the solution. I think we should both take the challenge, the carnivore challenge. We can do it together and track each other's progress and hold each other accountable.
So that's no grain or anything like that? No wheat?
No.
Oh, man. That sounds not healthy. Is that a thing? People are pushing that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, big time. Yeah, it's a whole thing.
You're kidding me.
I was looking at a bunch of videos of it today. Yeah. And apparently, like, and this is the thing. It's like people can point to, like, I've lost this amount of weight. I have more energy, whatever it is. But it's like there's no data you could show me to convince me that that's a healthy thing to do for your body. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you can lose 10, cholesterol, 15 pounds, diet, whatever. Yeah. I'm still not going to be convinced that that's going to be good for you. It's a whole big thing though. I think this is one of the things that like Jordan Peterson and Jordan Peterson's daughter was pushing. And look at that guy. He's healthy.
Yeah. He's doing great.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Everything about him, you should want to emulate.
It just screams health, his whole thing, you know? Like that one time he talked about drinking like a cup of cider and it like, he was like, I was up for 5 days afterwards or whatever it was. Like the cider, like gave him night terrors or something. I don't know. But, you know, he's the foremost intellectual of the right. So who am I? Who am I to suggest that he doesn't know what he's talking about? You know, he's a doctor.
Know your place. Know your place, Rob. Yeah.
Thank you. So I think maybe you just need to try that. just go out, get a bunch of ground beef and cream and just put it in like a blender. You pour that mm-hmm. into like a saucepan to form a base. Okay. Then you cook that, take that out, cut up some more meat and cheese, put it on the meat base, throw that in the oven. And then you eat that and you dunk it in a little bit of a cream. You dump it in some cream as like a dipping thing.
That people do this? That's just so much cholesterol. Like I'm blown away.
Yeah. Well.
Wow.
This is the hot health trend. Yeah.
Yeah, it will be us after our plunge, after our cold plunge.
What's going on the show today? Who are you talking to?
I talked to David Masiotra, the author of the upcoming book, Exurbia Now, The Battleground of American Democracy. This was a really fascinating conversation and book. He was kind enough to send over an advanced copy. It comes out on April 2nd, and it looks at towns outside of suburbs and how they are increasingly more right-wing and radical, and that is driven by anti-black hate. It was a really good conversation, helped me understand more about the Trump movement, the Trump base. And especially when you talk about, we've talked a lot about how Trump was, you know, flaunting classified documents at Mar-a-Lago to boat dealers and talking about how, you know, the January 6th was populated by a bunch of, you know, middle class professional types. In addition to just pure lunatics, right? So this book is a book of political geography and looks at people like that and where they live. And it's in these exurban towns. A really, really fascinating look at a part of America that doesn't get a real in-depth analysis. You'll often just get reporters stopping by for a weekend, talking to people at diners and heading home. So I really enjoyed this, really enjoyed the conversation. I think people are going to like it.
Cool. Well, yeah, what I think the Democrats should do is make sure you get all these people's views on the record, and then Biden should ignore everyone to the left of like Ronald Reagan and then try and bring those people into the coalition. And that's going to be a winning prospect for the Democratic Party. To make sure you, who cares about the, you know, the anti-genocide movement or the climate movement or young people, students, any of that stuff. You know, you don't need them. So I think this is the way you got to do it.
Yeah, we had a conversation at the end about the road ahead, because he says, like, I didn't want Biden to be the nominee. But, you know, looking at Trump, it's like, I obviously don't want him either. So it's like, what do? You find yourself in a pretty difficult situation. So, yeah, later on, we talk about how to deal with this in a moment where people are so disillusioned by the Biden administration.
That's the beauty. That's the beautiful American democracy in action. We love to see it.
Right. Right.
Anyway, that sounds really interesting. I'm looking forward to listening to that. Is there anything else we got to plug here, or what do you want to do?
Yeah. Earlier this week, we talked to Andrew Perez of Rolling Stone about a new report detailing talking points AIPAC was disseminating, telling allies, telling spokespeople to just deny that there's any starvation in Gaza. We get into AIPAC's spending and primaries in the general election, their influence in Washington, and a lot more. You can get that episode if you subscribe at insurgentspod.com for just $5 a month.
Yes, please subscribe to the podcast. If you can, folks, support the work that Jordan and I do on here. All kinds of really fantastic bonus content that we've put out over the last couple of weeks and months and years. Get access to all of that by subscribing over at insurgentspod.com.
Let's get into my conversation with David Masiotra.
And that conversation will be coming up right after this.
And now I'm joined by David Masiotra, author of the new book, Exurbia Now, The Battleground of American Democracy. David, thank you so much for joining me. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me. Been looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, same. I finished this book last week, and it's been on my mind a lot. And something that I rarely do, but maybe should do more, I gave my copy to a friend after he brought up a town that he was just in that he was kind of amazed by. It seemed pretty much entirely white, and it was in what he was describing as an excerpt. And I thought, oh, wow, you need to read this book. I just finished it, and it helped me understand these types of towns. So could you tell us, when you're talking about Exurbia now, these towns that are beyond the suburbs, what do you mean by that? Because I think understanding that is helpful for the rest of the book.
Of course, yeah. So an exurb is a town. We can differentiate a suburb and an exurb by distance and density. So Exurbia has greater distance from the metro area than suburbia, but less population density. So think of it as a town that resembles a suburb in some ways, which we might get into, but that is much further from an urban area than a suburb and has fewer people than a suburb. And they're really largely manufactured towns that they just kind of spring up in the middle of nowhere because real estate development firms and others feel that it's a good location for a town. And various political and cultural factors have led to their growth. And some of those are frightening, and many of them are worthy of examination, hence the book Exurbia Now.
Just as the suburbs started to populate, and that population was driven by anti-blackness, it seems that is carrying on as the suburbs get more diverse, more inclusive, more welcoming. People, the same types of people are now fleeing the suburbs and going to the exurbs. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's crucial. So one of the assertions of this book, and the book is a work of political geography, is that journalists look at the who, what, where, when, why, and how. And over the past 9 years, in the myriad attempts to explore and examine this dangerous reactionary autocratic cult surrounding Donald Trump, one factor that so many of the analysts and journalists have neglected is the where. And what the research indicates is that Donald Trump's electoral returns are highest in Exurbia. His support in Exurbia is off the charts. And the most psychotic members of Congress, people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert and Matt Gaetz and Jim Jordan, represent districts that are predominantly exurban. So what is happening in Exurbia that is leading to the creation of a staging ground for right-wing neo-fascist politics? That's where the book begins. And in order to understand the where, you also have to understand that Exurbia, in large part, is an adverse reaction to changes that have taken place in suburbia. So I grew up in Lansing, Illinois. When I grew up in Lansing, Illinois, which is a south suburb of Chicago, it was almost entirely white. Now, Lansing, Illinois, like much of America, is very diverse. I believe it's about half Black. There's a significant Latino population there. The white flight that occurred in the south suburbs, including Lansing, was one of the fastest on record. And of course, it took place all across the country, urban and suburban areas throughout the country. Exurbia is the next stage of white flight. So as the suburbs like Lansing have become more diverse, more multicultural, and in some cases even more progressive, enraged white prejudicial voters who don't like what they see in their immediate surroundings have moved further from the cities to these towns that we call exurbs. So that's Exurbia Now, and that's why it's the battleground of American democracy, because it is central headquarters of the MAGA movement.
You talk about scenes that you saw in these towns where even in some small towns, people would try to have like pride events or demonstrate inclusivity at storefronts. And pretty quickly they would be met with militia members or people showing up with arms. And I think generally listeners and most people are aware that is happening, but I think they always associate it with, oh, this couldn't happen here, or, oh, that's, you know, so much of it does seem to happen in Portland, or, oh, that's just a state with open carry, or, you know, it couldn't happen here. And what you're showing is this type of what we saw as fringe militaristic behavior is popping up all over the country in these types of towns, because these fringe views have become so unfortunately popular in these parts of America.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And what you're highlighting is a real failure of the mainstream media, that we're living in an era of political violence and terror. The United States Army defines terrorism as the use or threat of violence to achieve a political or religious objective. So there's a town close to where I sit right now. If you were to visit, it's called Crown Point, Indiana. If you were to visit the town, it's picturesque, it's charming, it has a beautiful courthouse square. I've had many, you know, fun afternoons and long nights in that town. When they had a Black Lives Matter event in 2020 following the murder of George Floyd, the event itself was organized by high school and college students. So some of the people leading this event were teenagers. They were minors. And yet they were flanked by white men and some white women holding assault rifles. Now, this is, to put it mildly, disturbing. And I ask the question in Exurbia now, what happens when they decide to start shooting? Now, a little bit to the east of Crown Point, there's a town called Chesterton. Some high school students there, and again, I'll emphasize, these are minors. Not that this behavior would be acceptable if it was presented against adults, but these are minors. Some high school students walked out of their high school on the one-year anniversary of the Parkland shooting, and they wanted to have 19 minutes of silence to honor the 19 victims of that shooting. Various members of the NRA locals who brought their right-wing paraphernalia, Trump flags, and so forth, they started cursing at these students, trying to attack them. A few were even arrested. I mean, this is something that happens with some regularity in these parts of the country, so much so that I have a good friend who lives in Kalamazoo, Michigan, and his wife was involved in an LGBTQ advocacy group in that area, and they were met by the Proud Boys and militias at several of their events, and she quit the organization because she was frightened. She was intimidated. So that's why I say we're living in this era of political violence and terror that undermines our democracy, and the media, the mainstream media, is not reporting it nearly to the extent that it should. And that's why I try to spotlight it as much as possible in this book. People know about Kyle Rittenhouse, who is from an exurb, and they know about the plot to assassinate Governor Gretchen Whitmer, and many of the plotters were from exurbs. But they don't know about these smaller acts of violence or intimidation that are taking place, because fortunately, up until now, they haven't been tragic. We don't have any casualties, but the threat is there.
It also, you talk about it in the book. I think part of the reason why we don't hear about it as often is just local news has been struggling for so long. I grew up in Youngstown. Our paper, which was, you know, like the flagship paper in the area for over 100 years, shut down several years ago. They just couldn't afford to keep publishing. I think that's just the canary in the coal mine for what small independent papers are going to deal with over the next decade or so. And you're going to have this just blackout area where you might get some TV coverage from a major city nearby, or you might get some aggregated information from a wire service. But in terms of focusing on truly local issues, it's going to be a struggle. You'll have to rely on Nextdoor, which is just totally unreliable and probably prone to misinformation, fringe beliefs, conspiracy theories, that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. There are a great deal of this country lives in what experts refer to as news deserts. And 2/3 of newspapers shut down between the years 2000 and 2020. And hundreds of newspapers have shut down since. So that means in the past 24 years, we've lost over 2/3 of our newspapers. What that means is you have these towns that function as what I refer to in Exurbia now as Nowhere USA. They have no local community. They have no local culture. So therefore, the people living in those towns, if they're looking for some news report, they're likely to go to national outlets. And I have this, you know, attempt at humor in saying that Tucker Carlson becomes your local newsman if you live in an exurb. And people who live in these towns therefore become very susceptible to conspiratorial delusion and prejudicial and paranoid thinking, because they're being frightened into believing that something is happening right outside of their doorstep, and there isn't any local media there to tell them otherwise. So it's a major problem. And then the degradation of local media also occurs at the national level, because you have fewer reporters and journalists of national influence paying any attention to local media. So we learned this with the ridiculous George Santos scandal. There was a local paper in Long Island that reported on many of his lies before the race. But it's like, you know, a tree falling in the forest. If nobody hears it, that old cliche conundrum. If a newspaper publishes an article and no one reads it, you know, does it really exist? In the case of Santos, it didn't, and he won the race. So we're creating this kind of dead zone in parts of the country that with no connection to community, communal institutions, no local media, and people who live in these dead zones are highly susceptible to a right-wing reactionary message, because it's easy to believe that the Latino immigrant or the Black Lives Matter activist or the transgender teenager is a threat to you and your family when you've never met one of those people. But when they live right next door to you, or there's a local newspaper article about the transgender teenager in your town or the Latino migrants in your town, it's much harder to believe that they're a threat to your safety and security.
Let's talk about some of the areas that you write about and you describe. You talk about post-industrial America and the Rust Belt, where we're seeing a rightward shift in some cases, previous Dem strongholds. And you talk about how fascism thrives when there is this sense of economic instability, and right-wing demagogues exploit that. I mean, it's a mix of an absence of reliable news information, but also just true economic instability. And I think in the aftermath of 2016, you saw a lot of people, a lot of reporters, just go visit some of these towns for a weekend, talk to people at diners, and then characterize Trump's victory as, well, these are just, you know, upset white working class people. They're just mad. And I think there is part of that. It doesn't dismiss what Trump said about people who are marginalized or immigrants or women, all of these things. Like, they go hand in hand. I think they exploit that economic instability by otherizing people, by pointing the finger and blaming these people's problems on women, on immigrants, on people of color. Could you talk about why you took such a close look at this area, which the conventional mainstream media has been to just summarily dismiss as an upset white working class?
Well, the first and foremost is because I live here. I mean, I live in a small town in Indiana, and I've lived in this area my entire life. So I'm very familiar with Chicago, the suburbs that surround it, and the exurbs that are further from it. So for the past 9 years, I've seen so many reports by journalists who, you know, parachute into a town, and the second they take off their parachute, they run into a diner and interview some guy in a baseball cap. No offense, you're wearing a baseball cap, about you know, why he supports Donald Trump. And, you know, as I said before, I knew that I either had to write this book or become an arsonist and find these diners just so we could stop these reports, because they're so inane and simplistic, and they reduce everything to cliches and sound bites. So there are so many. I live very close to Gary, Indiana, and that's the city that I really make the focus of my reportage in this book about post-industrial America, because Gary transitioned from having the nickname Magic City to then having the nickname Murder Capital of the World to now it's just pretty much a ghost town. There's nothing there except the university where I teach, but there's almost nothing else surrounding it. I mean, students can't even find a bar to have a beer after class. And there are so many misunderstandings. So first of all, even though Trump and Republicans have made considerable gains with working class Americans, they still up until this point have never won a majority of those voters. That Biden won a majority of voters making up into $50,000 per year, and he won a majority of voters making between $50,000 and $100,000 per year. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that at some point, the David Brooks types of the world got the asinine idea that's just a source of endless bafflement to define working class as someone without a college degree. So that means that a elementary school teacher making $33,000 a year is not working class, but an electrician or a plumber making $75,000 a year is working class. So, I mean, the media presentation of class is wrong on so many levels that what I attempt to do in Exurbia now is examine what is actually happening with the disruption and upheaval of the classes in the United States, and why is it that, for example, when I was young, my father could start his own trucking company and for many years thrive, and my grandfather worked in the material service quarry in Thornton, Illinois, one of the largest quarries in the United States, and thrive. And what does the disappearance of those jobs really mean for the future of our country, and why has the disappearance of those jobs 30, 40 years after the fact, because it didn't happen immediately, helped to add some fuel to the fire of the MAGA movement. But one thing that I would add to that is it's very important not to dismiss the economic factors, but it's also very important not to fall into the media trap of depicting the average Trump supporter as the reincarnation of Tom Joad. What the research continually finds is not that economics is irrelevant, but that the primary drivers of this movement to undermine American democracy are culture and identity. It's hostility towards immigrants, hostility towards the diversification of America, and hostility towards secularism and the rise of more women and LGBTQ people in positions of prominence and power.
Yeah, that's something that I think we have to center. You warn about people who reduce their outreach, reduce their understanding just to a class-only framework. And the perils of that is that it still hangs these groups that you purportedly care about out to dry in your messaging. And they can be linked, and they should be linked. If you want a strong, robust, multicultural democracy, which I think we should all celebrate and fight for, you can't just reduce everything to class. These issues are intersectional, and you warn about people who don't see it that way. I think that's a really important point to make. I mean, what would you add to that? What did you see, and what upset you? What caused you to issue that warning?
Well, there is a certain segment of the left that, as you say, reduces so much to class and continually almost offers an excuse for the neo-fascist politics surrounding Donald Trump by depicting his voters as beleaguered victims of globalization. Now, undoubtedly, some of them are. But first of all, that ignores so much of the data, as I've already alluded to earlier. Most of Donald Trump's supporters are not working class unless you use the asinine David Brooks definition. And furthermore, I'm endlessly baffled and aggrieved that 9 years later, there are still people having this conversation, because if we just apply some logic, Donald Trump was elected in 2016 by saying the American dream is dead and by depicting the United States of America as a hellscape fit for a Slayer song, as you have the logo behind you. And I hope we get at least a couple questions about Slayer in this discussion.
Absolutely.
And then in 2020, he ran for re-election saying that he had created the greatest economy in the history of money. That's a verbatim quote. I mean, Donald Trump says many ridiculous things. He actually did say that. And everybody voted for him who voted for him the first, or nearly everyone voted for him who voted for him the first time. So obviously there's something else going on beyond economics here, because he couldn't have revolutionized the country in 4 years. So that is, and like I said, an endless source of aggravation. And in order to understand this movement that so threatens this country, we have to get out of these traps of nostalgia. You know, nostalgia for the smokestacks, nostalgia for the hard hat workers carrying their lunch boxes to work. There were some wonderful things about the manufacturing era of the American economy, but there were some terrible things about it too. But whether you liked it or you don't like it, you have to recognize that, for example, the fast food chain Arby's has more employees than the entire coal industry right now. So raising the minimum wage would do more to help the poor and the working class than, you know, forget about climate change, if we could save the entire coal industry. And one of the ways that we can learn about this is by visiting these exurban towns, because I see it when I drive through them. But the Wall Street Journal has reported that wealth in exurbia is actually higher than the median households of America. That in exurbia, you often have new home developments, and that's what attracts many middle class and upper middle class people to these towns. And this is the support for Donald Trump that receives far less attention than the white working class people of rural America. But it's the support for Donald Trump that's more consequential, because there are far greater numbers of them, and they have more money to donate to campaigns, to subscribe to Stephen Bannon's podcast, and so on and so forth.
You talk about a couple different large spectacles that you've seen throughout exurbia time and time again, and that is mega churches and casinos. You see these pop up in exurban areas throughout. What do those two different entities, while seemingly at odds with one another, what do they say about exurbia, the state of exurbia, and how people connect to each one?
Well, starting with mega churches, most mega churches are in exurbia. And that starts with a very practical reason. You can't build, I mean, suppose you could, but it would be difficult to build a church the size of a basketball arena in the middle of Chicago or in the middle of a densely populated suburban area. So exurbia has the open space for these mega churches. So that's why about 20 years ago, when mega churches first started to become very popular, most of them were in exurban areas. Now they act almost as a magnet for a certain type of voter to exurbia, because people start going to church there and then they want to move closer to their church, especially if they're devout and they're going to church on Sunday and Bible class in the middle of the week and their kids go to Sunday school, and et cetera, et cetera. And what many of these mega churches have become are citadels of Christian theocratic nationalism, which always had racism at its center. So one of the mistakes that many people make is the assumption that the Christian right formulated and became an important part of the formed and became an important part of the Republican Party as a reaction against abortion and maybe gay rights. The reality, as Randall Balmer has documented, one of the best historians of American Christianity, is that the Christian right organized as a movement of resistance against school integration. And they turned on one of their own, President Jimmy Carter, because he punished schools in the South, Christian schools, that refused to admit Black, Latino, and Native American students. So, ironically, Charles Darwin, not exactly a hero to the Christian right, has the best description of their political movement. You know them by their lowly origin. Politics of exclusion are still at the center of the Christian right. Exclusion of independent-minded, sexually progressive women, exclusion of gay and transgendered people, exclusion of anyone who adheres to a philosophy different than right-wing Christian nationalism. So at the center of exurban towns that became more populous due to exclusionary beliefs are these religious institutions that practice and proliferate exclusionary beliefs. And that's another factor that is part and parcel of the fascist cult surrounding Donald Trump, Christian nationalism, that we can separate from economics, to go back to your earlier question. Now, on the question of economics, casinos are what many towns, especially post-industrial towns, have gambled on, pun intended, to resurrect their economies and to resurrect some recreational culture in their community. And what the data shows over the past 20 to 30 years is it just doesn't work. In fact, it often works against the local economy, because if you own a bar in Gary, Indiana, even though, like I said, it's hard to find one, and now there's a casino in Gary, Indiana, well, that's a competitor. Someone might go to that casino to get a beer and not your bar. And what you're very clever to draw that connection between the casino and the megachurch, because the Bible defines faith as evidence of things unseen. The megachurch is proliferating an ideology of faith in that they want their adherents to believe in the unseen America, the America of white, heterosexual, conservative dominance. And casinos make their way into these towns, inspiring those who welcome them to act according to the faith without evidence, because you can't see it, that the casino will resurrect the town. And of course, one of the stories that I spotlight in the book is how Donald Trump, who before he became a failed president, was a failed casino magnate, perhaps the first in the history of the enterprise. But this is the genius who's, you know, going to save our economy and save the jobs. Got the city of Gary to green light a casino project for him with all of these false promises that he put money in the schools, he put money in the community centers, he'd revitalize the downtown. And of course, he did none of that. And by time he left and the casino closed, the town had nothing to show for it. Now, Donald Trump, as we all know, is an egregious con artist. So that's an egregious case. But generally, that's what happens when casinos move into town. The townspeople believe that it's going to save their struggling economy, and it never materializes.
It's just a tax on the working class and the working poor. And you talk about how for local governments, if they do tax the casinos, you know, sometimes there's nice packages to woo businesses to come to the area where they just will give them a special deal. But in that case, it's you're still taxing people without actually raising taxes. So if you're in a government position, it's great. You're getting something for free at no cost. It's not politically unpopular and people don't realize it. It's really insidious how that it just, I saw it happen in my hometown. Just the businesses were gone. And all of a sudden we had a casino. Just why? So I appreciate that you helped me understand why that seems to keep popping up in these areas.
And one thing I'll say about that very quickly is there's something going on similar to the exurban economy in general, even in the exurbs that are more middle class and upper middle class. You see very few locally owned and operated businesses, but rather they attract corporate chains. So when you bet $100 at the casino, and if you lose, that $100 doesn't go into the local economy. Just like if you spend $100 on a meal at Chili's or Applebee's, of course, some of that money will make it in the local economy, but most of it is going to a corporate headquarters, as opposed to going to a locally owned restaurant where you're actually helping the community. So that's another interesting connection to make between the casino and the exurban economic landscape more broadly.
Because what do you think? And I know this is a broad question, and maybe there isn't a clear answer or a concise answer, but what is the antidote to this extremism that we're seeing popularize in these areas? Time allowing, you know, capacity allowing. Even if it's not a complete solution, what is the first step or two that people listening to this, the people that read the book, the people who are generally concerned about this, what should they do to fight back?
Well, thanks for teeing up resurrecting our democracy for me. No pressure at all. I really appreciate it.
It's all on you, David.
So one thing that I would say, if people watching this, and I'm assuming that most of the people in this audience are like-minded. So I would say that you have to face the threat honestly, first and foremost, and don't delude yourself about the threat. But I'm going to break the question down into short term and long term. So in the short term, as cliched as it sounds, you have to vote in this next election. And I don't work for the Biden administration or the Biden campaign. So I'm honest. I tell people that I wish Biden would have dropped out of the race 6 months to a year ago. And that the Democratic Party would have had a robust, lively primary, and we'd have a different candidate. And so Biden, for all of his flaws, you know, he's the guy showing up with the fire hose to the burning building. And if the firefighter with the fire hose has, you know, bad breath and bad taste in music, he doesn't like any Slayer records, you still let them spray the water on your house because you know, we're, to quote Liz Cheney, we're sleepwalking into a dictatorship, and Trump is advertising his dangerous agenda in no uncertain terms. So that's the short-term effect. And if you study how this change has taken place within the Republican Party, it was involvement on the ground with the Tea Party, involvement on the ground with the MAGA types. So progressives could learn a lesson from that. Rather than distance yourself from the Democratic Party, engage with it, and eventually try to push it more into a leftward direction, which has already happened on major issues in the past 5 years. So that's the short term. I wrote a book about Jesse Jackson, and you know, Jesse Jackson has registered more people to vote than anyone in American history. And he's always said that if we vote, our numbers will win. If we don't vote, our numbers will lose. That applies. In terms of the long term, some of this will change, but I'm not one of these people who think demographics is the savior. I mean, the demographics work to our advantage, but we can't rely on it alone. So in long-term thinking, we have to do a couple of things. We have to make it so that this extreme form of right-wing politics earns people pariah status. And then we also have to engage with some patience and respect with those in our immediate circle. Now, that sounds contradictory, but I think culturally, we have to indicate that we have zero tolerance for racism, zero tolerance for extremism, but with our own family, our own friends, and our own neighbors, we still have to listen to people and try to have conversation and try to get through with them beginning on their terms. So you're not going to convince your gun-toting MAGA uncle to volunteer for the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez campaign by using the vocabulary we're accustomed to using. But what I have found when I've had fruitful conversations with people, I begin by asking them questions. And then I try to steer the conversation in a more productive direction. I don't know if any of that makes sense.
It absolutely does. Yeah.
But one thing I would emphasize, going back to Jesse Jackson and some of the things I've learned from him, is for people who feel despondent right now, I once asked him how he ends every speech with "keep hope alive." And he said, sometimes when you're climbing yourself out of a hole, you get so focused on the distance that you have yet to climb that you forget to look behind you and see how far you've already come. We've come so far on issues of race. We've come so far on issues of gender. We've come so far on issues of LGBTQ acceptance and opportunities. And if we could just harness the tactics that worked on those fights toward economic issues and other political issues, we can begin to accumulate more victories, but that requires sustained activism, involvement, and participation. So another important thing to keep in mind about combating extremism in exurbia is the necessity of involvement at the local level. So often, because our political conversation has gone national, people think of participation and involvement only in national terms. So some of the real heroes that I profile in exurbia now are people who are dedicated to changing their towns, changing their counties. And what you find is when you go to your, if you live in a small town and you go to the town council meeting, for example, the four or five people who consistently show up dominate. So it doesn't take a great amount of people to change local politics. I tell the story of Robert Cotton, who was the first part of the first Black family to move into a town called Valparaiso, Indiana, which when he moved there, he and his mom, it was a sundown town. Now he's on the city council. And I also tell the story of an environmental group in the town where I live. They advocate for sustainability policies, and they actually got the town council, which at the time was 3-2, Republican to Democrat, to adopt a sustainability commission in which the town will study ways to implement policies more geared towards conservation and sustainability and having more carbon-friendly policies and programs. So if you care about politics and you care about fighting things like book bans and terrible environmental policies at the local level and terrible policies against LGBTQ children at the local level, then you have to get involved at the local level. It's not enough just to vote for president or even governor or member of Congress, but go to your town council meeting and find like-minded people and advocate block by block, house by house.
I think it's an especially dangerous sentiment when you have, you talk about how, you weren't super excited that Biden was the nominee, but you feel an obligation to go out and vote for him because obviously Trump is worse. I think a lot of people, if they're in that camp, might think, what do I need to show up for the primary for? It's uncontested. We're not choosing anybody. It's already picked for us. But they're neglecting a lot of these key local races or helping shape who your congressional nominee is if you have a contested House race. And especially positions like school boards and city councils where the right has been making inroads for years to shift culture to the right. I mean, Rolling Stone just did a story this week on Leonard Leo, the guy who is the co-chair of the Federalist Society, who has over $1 billion from one single donor that he can throw around at his disposal. And he is making it clear his next objective is to shift the entire culture to the right. It's not just the judiciary anymore. It's everything. So you absolutely have to pay attention to local races. It's easy not to, and sometimes it's difficult in some of these areas if you don't have a lot of reporting on the ground or a robust local news infrastructure. So it's a lot of work, but there is an obligation, especially if you want to see things like a student or a school board that isn't filled with Moms for Liberty types, because that's a target for them. So you absolutely have to fight back. I appreciate you making that point.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. And as you're wise to point out, the right wing is doing it. I mean, this is one of Steve Bannon's rallying cries to become an election worker, get on your board of trustees at your local library, run for school board. So if they're doing it and we're not, we know how that's going to go.
Well, David, before I let you go, I have to ask, do you have a favorite Slayer album?
South Side of Heaven.
Okay. What is there? What about it? Is it tied to, a formative moment in your life? Does it remind you of a certain era? Is it something about the style?
The style that it's some of the songs, like the title track, are a little more melodic, which I appreciate. And it was probably also because it's my first Slayer record. So, nothing like your first love. I also, I have a soft spot for Hell Awaits because, sometimes I put it on in the car and I time the drive so that my drive ends right when the record ends. And then I get out of the car feeling like I just had 4 shots of whiskey and Mike Tyson punched me in the face. And for some bizarre reason, it's a very pleasurable moment, in the parking lot or on the street side parking. So yeah. Hell Awaits and South Side of Heaven.
So you like the original, like the old, true thrash sound.
Yeah. When it comes to Slayer, those are my faves. And interestingly enough, I'm opposite with Metallica. With Metallica, okay, I really like the Black Album. And as much as people ridicule them, I love Load and Reload. So I don't know. That's something strange going on in my psyche. But I will say, I don't think there are many Slayer fans in Exurbia. There's not going to be an Exurbian tour.
As long as you don't say Saint Anger, I think we're okay. Oh, yeah, no,
Saint Anger. Saint Anger can go the way of Donald Trump's candidacy for re-election.
David, I want to thank you so much for your time and for writing this book, Exurbia Now, The Battleground of American Democracy, available on April 2nd. If you can pre-order your copy now, I would highly recommend it. It was a really enjoyable read. David, thank you. Where can people find more of your work?
I write regularly for a number of different websites, Salon, The Washington Monthly, and occasionally at The New Republic. So I'm a happily married, monogamous man, but as a writer, I'm very promiscuous. So just punch my name into Google and you'll find me.
I appreciate your time, David. Thank you so much for joining me.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you.